This is Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, ticked off, New York State is among the states with some of the highest reported numbers of Lyme disease and other tick-borne illnesses. Reporter Maren Scotton checks in with the New York State Department of Health about what to keep in mind as you head outdoors this summer to avoid these blood-sucking fiends. Science Stories with Joe Johnson. Retired science teacher and Radio Catskill volunteer Joe Johnson brings us some stories from science that caught his eye this week, including astronauts stranded in space and some other insects to worry about, Joro spiders. Moving toward health, Maggie Fitzpatrick is here from the Sullivan County Democrat, and we check in with the Calicoon Business Association about what's coming up this summer. First, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Hurricane Beryl is charging through the Caribbean Sea. The Category 5 storm has top sustained winds of 165 miles per hour. It first made landfall yesterday on a small island near Grenada. That country's prime minister says the island has been, quote, flattened. At least one person there has been killed. The hurricane is now aiming at Jamaica. Senior hurricane specialist Eric Blake of the National Hurricane Center says Beryl will likely lose strength when it hits tomorrow.
Right now we're forecasting it near Category 3 strength near Jamaica, but we shouldn't get too tied up on the exact number. We have some uncertainty. We do expect it to be a significant event with life-threatening winds and storm surge for that island.
Part of the Cayman Islands are also in the path of the hurricane. Later this week, Beryl could strike Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. The U.S. Supreme Court closed out its session yesterday with a hugely consequential and historic decision on presidential immunity. The opinion grants former President Donald Trump substantial immunity from prosecution over charges that he illegally sought to subvert Joe Biden's election victory in 2020. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more.
The court's 6-3 decision, along ideological lines, will almost certainly delay Trump's trial until after the November election, if it takes place at all. Writing for the conservative supermajority, Chief Justice John Roberts established a broad new immunity for former presidents, declaring that they may not be prosecuted for exercising their core constitutional powers. Even after leaving office, said Roberts, former presidents are entitled to at least the presumption of immunity from prosecution for actions they took as president. Of the six Republican-appointed justices, only Amy Coney Barrett would have put more limits on a former president's immunity for his actions while president. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks opened lower this morning as the Biden administration proposed a new rule to protect workers from excessive heat. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped a fraction in early trading.
The proposed rule comes as much of the country is baking under scorching summer temperatures. It's designed to protect some 36 million workers, including those at farms, factories, kitchens, and construction sites. If finalized, the rule would require employers to provide rest breaks, shade, water, and training in how to respond to heat-related illness. Exports of liquid natural gas could get a boost from a federal judge's ruling in Louisiana. The judge says consideration of future export terminals can proceed, despite a decision by the Biden administration to put those projects on hold. Inflation in Europe continues to cool. New figures out today show June prices in the eurozone were 2.5% higher than a year ago. We'll get a readout on June inflation in the U.S. next week. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News. Officials in northern India say at least 60 people have been killed in a stampede. They say the disaster happened during a religious ceremony. There's concern the death toll will rise. Voters in the United Kingdom go to the polls on Thursday. They'll choose members of the British Parliament and determine the shape of the UK's next government. The Conservative Party has led Britain for the past 14 years, but current polling suggests the Conservatives may lose ground to the opposition Labour Party. California is bracing for an extended and dangerous heat wave. As NPR's Nathan Rott reports, triple-digit highs are expected in some parts of the state through Sunday.
Nighttime is not expected to bring much relief in the coming week, with temperatures forecast to stay high even after the sun goes down. Authorities are warning about elevated risk of wildfires and worsened air quality with the soaring temperatures. Strong forecasted winds have also prompted Pacific Gas and Electric, the state's largest utility, to warn it may preemptively shut off power for some customers in Northern California to avoid starting wildfires. Extreme heat is the deadliest weather event. Health officials are urging people to be aware of the conditions through the holiday weekend. Nathan Rott, NPR News.
Meanwhile, across the country, nearly 83 million people are under some kind of heat caution today. That includes parts of the central and southern U.S., from Kansas to the Florida Panhandle. Parts of Arkansas, Mississippi, and Tennessee are under excessive heat watches. Heat indexes could rise there to 113 degrees. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One, offering their travel card, Venture. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation at rwjf.org. Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. It's tick season, and tick safety is as important as ever. About 50,000 cases of tick-borne illnesses are reported to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention every year. Lyme, the most prevalent tick-borne disease in the United States, is potentially debilitating and can be difficult to diagnose. Plus, in 2023, the CDC reported that a different tick-borne illness, babesiosis, which can present asymptomatically or with flu-like symptoms, has been on the rise in the Northeast and Midwest over the last few years. Reporter Maren Scotton spoke to Melissa Pruszynski from the New York State Department of Health about what to keep in mind as you head outdoors this summer.
Ticks are not insects. They're arachnids. Actually, they're more closely related to spiders than they are to your housefly, for example. They hatch from an egg and they go through three active life stages called the larvae, which would be the baby, the nymph, sort of the teenager, and the adult. And in order to grow and develop into the next life stage, they have to feed on blood once before molting, growing, and developing to the next active life stage. So a typical tick is actually pretty long lived. They can live up to 3 years. And they need to feed on a different animal or blood source each time to grow and develop into that next active life stage. And that's where they can pick up pathogens from wild animals and then transmit them to people.
Where are you most likely to find a tick or to contract a tick bite?
So ticks are often found in woody areas and grassy areas, especially along the what they call edge ecotone, so where the woods butt up to the lawn or butt up to a field. And the immature stages, those larvae and nymphs, are often found in the leaf litter and in low-lying vegetation, so no more than 6 inches above the ground. But you can readily encounter them when you're gardening or removing leaves from around your house or foundation, hiking in the woods, particularly if you don't stay in the center of the trail where there's bare mineral soil or sand that you can see. And then the adult ticks, they tend to climb up a little higher on the vegetation, up to about 3 feet above the ground, and they can crawl onto you from any overhanging vegetation like bushes or grasses that you brush up against, and they'll crawl quickly onto you. There are a number of things that you can do to avoid tick bites. Some of them folks are really familiar with, and it's the same public health messaging that we've been giving for quite a while. These include wearing light-colored clothing with a tight weave and tucking your shirt into your pants and your pant cuffs into your socks. And what this does is it limits access to your skin, so ticks are forced to crawl upward on your body. And then with the light-colored clothing, you're more likely to look down and recognize that they're there and brush them off before they have a chance to attach to your skin. And then you can also consider using insect repellent. Not everything that's effective against mosquitoes is effective against ticks. So you want to look for something like DEET, Picaridin, or IR3535. There's actually a guidance video starring my finger on the New York State Department of website that shows which repellents are effective against ticks. And then some newer guidance, pulling your hair back so that you don't have your hair come in contact with the ground when you're gardening. Throwing your clothes into the dryer on high heat after you're done with outdoor activity to kill any ticks that might be attached, you know, running them for about 10 minutes, maybe more if the clothes are damp or sweaty to kill any ticks that are on there. And then showering soon after you return indoors, preferably immediately, but within 2 hours, gives you an opportunity to do a full body tick check and see and remove any ticks that have attached to you, but also wash away or brush off any ticks that haven't had an opportunity to bite you. And those are probably the best ways to avoid getting a tick-borne illness. Just keep checking constant vigilance when you're outdoors. And don't forget about your pets. Your furry friends can bring ticks into the house. People oftentimes treat their pets with a flea and tick preventative. Sometimes it's a collar or a topical skin. Sometimes it's something that they feed their pet. And it will repel the ticks, but you don't want them ending up on you. So checking your pet thoroughly before they come indoors, definitely before they share the couch or bed with you, will go a long way to help preventing ticks.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the biggest health risks that come from a tick bite?
So not everybody knows that there are over 30 different types of ticks or species of ticks in New York State, 10 of which frequently bite people. And really only 4 of those are considered medically important. These include the black-legged tick, which a lot of folks know as the deer tick or by its scientific name, Ixodes scapularis. And so this is sort of public health enemy number one in New York State when it comes to tick-borne disease, because they're responsible for transmitting the bacteria that causes Lyme disease. We have over 8,000 cases of Lyme reported each year in New York State. They also transmit the bacteria that causes anaplasmosis. We have more than 1,000 cases of that, and the incidence is increasing in certain regions of upstate New York. We have babesiosis, also transmitted by the black-legged tick. It's sort of like malaria, but transmitted by ticks, and that particular disease is spreading in New York. We have a relapsing fever caused by a bacteria that's a distant cousin to the one that causes Lyme disease, as well as Powassan encephalitis, which is a rare but serious infection caused by a virus. And all of these are transmitted by the black-legged or deer tick. We also have the American dog tick, which transmits Rocky Mountain spotted fever. We do have that here in New York State. It's more rare than some of the other tick-borne illnesses, as well as tularemia. And we have the woodchuck tick, which can also transmit that virus that causes Powassan encephalitis. And then the Lone Star tick, which is very abundant on Long Island and may be increasing in certain regions. And they transmit the bacteria that causes Ehrlichiosis, as well as Heartland and Bourbon virus. And interestingly, bites from this particular tick species have been associated with some individuals developing an allergy to red meat. Mm-hmm. So not a disease per se, but you know, something that can be a serious condition. And all of these diseases that I've mentioned, if left untreated, can become very serious illness or even result in death.
And if someone gets home after being outside and does find a tick on themselves, what should they do?
The first thing, which is hard, don't freak out. Take a deep breath. And then you're going to want to remove the tick with fine pointed tweezers. Not your fingers, not any other method, not even the tweezers you use for, you know, plucking an eyebrow hair. You want really fine pointed tweezers like you'd use to remove a splinter. Grasp the tick as close to the mouth parts or head as possible where it goes into the skin, and then pull upward away from the skin with slow, constant motion until the tick releases. And that really is the best way to remove them. You don't want to squeeze the body of the tick, because that can actually inject the bacteria or other pathogens into your skin, similar to a hypodermic needle. And you don't want to irritate the tick in any way. You don't want to put any chemicals or burn it or anything like that, because that will also cause it to regurgitate its gut contents and essentially inoculate you with the bacteria that is carrying.
And you mentioned that Lyme disease is really common. What are some of the recognizable symptoms of Lyme disease, and what should someone do if they're experiencing any of those?
So Lyme disease does have a telltale rash that about 80% of people experience. They call it the erythema migrans or bullseye rash. Basically, it's a red area that expands larger than the size of a golf ball in diameter. It can be at the tick bite site, or it can be located elsewhere on the body. Sometimes, unfortunately, it's under your hair or in an area where you can't readily see it. So some of the other symptoms include fever, fatigue, joint and muscle pain, basically feeling really cruddy, flu-like symptoms, nausea, vomiting, that sort of thing, but just really feeling under the weather and run down during the warm winter or warm summer months is a good indicator.
And what should someone do if they're experiencing any of those symptoms?
They should consult their medical provider as soon as possible, because prompt and appropriate treatment, either with antibiotics or in the case of babesiosis with antimalarial medications, really provides the best outcome. These are serious, you know, body-wide infections, and they need to be treated promptly and diagnosed correctly and treated promptly for the best public health outcome.
That was my last question. Anything you want to add or any final tips regarding tick safety for people out there listening?
Well, if people are curious about tick risk in their particular region of New York State, we recently released a map on the New York State Department of Health website that shows tick risk at the regional level. We use the I Love New York tourism regions because a lot of folks, if they're going hiking and they're traveling within the state, or if they're visiting from out of state or out of country, they don't necessarily know what county or maybe what town they're going to be in, but they know that they're in the Finger Lakes or the Adirondacks, and they can check out their risk of encountering a tick infected with any pathogen. So any of the diseases that I mentioned, just a relative risk score to show you where the riskiest areas are. We're hoping that everybody will take precautions anytime that they're going to spend time outdoors in New York, but it's important to know your risks so that you can advise your doctor when you get home if you do get sick, and you can tell them that you've been in an area that was risky for ticks and tick-borne disease. And we also post the infection rates for our tick surveillance program, where we collect ticks from parks and other public areas at the county level on the Health Data NY website. It can be accessed from the state health department's website as well, if you're curious what the different rates of pathogens are in ticks for your particular county.
That was Melissa Prusinski from the New York State Department of Health on summer tick safety. In Liberty, I'm Maren Scotton for Radio Catskill.
And we'll take a break. And when we come back, some news about another arachnid, Joro spiders, and other science stories that caught our eye this week. Science Stories with Joe Johnson, next on Radio Chatskill.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
I'm Bill Williams. Join me for the Kingfisher Project tonight at 6, when my guest will be Rob Kent, founder and president of Kent Strategic Advisors. We'll be talking about the current state of drug use and healthcare policy in the state of New York. That's the Kingfisher Project, Information Against Eviction, tonight at 6 on the Local Edition, only on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Joe Johnson is a former Port Jervis science teacher and Radio Catskill volunteer, and he brings us some science stories every week that caught his eye. This morning, we're talking about the Earth's core slowing down, alarm over the possible arrival of the Joro spider, which has sparked concern across the Northeast over these scary-looking eight-legged creatures, and Boeing has two astronauts stuck in space at the International Space Station.
This was Boeing's bid to provide crew transport to and from the ISS in low Earth orbit. It can hold up to 7 astronauts. It's reusable for up to 10 missions, supposedly. This is the third mission they've launched with the Starliner, and it's the first that actually made it to dock with the space station. Anyway, the backstory on it is, back in 2010, NASA awarded contracts to both the Boeing Starliner and SpaceX to create the Crew Dragon. They were looking to have a commercial crew program so that they could ferry astronauts back and forth to the ISS. The Boeing program has been plagued by delays and technical problems, valves, all kinds of problems. Their first flight was supposed to be 2017, but they didn't launch until 2019. And that was kind of a partial failure or success, depending on who you talk to, because it did not dock. There was a computer problem. There was a clock problem, and they missed the space station, basically. The second flight in 2022, lots of delays, software and hardware issues. Again, it did dock with the space station. There was nobody on board. It was an uncrewed module. Now, this current mission launched on June 5th of this year, after many delays and helium leaks. In fact, they knew they had one small leak when they launched, but NASA cleared them to launch. On their approach to the ISS to dock with the ISS, five of the 28 RCS, or Reaction Control System thrusters, this is how they maneuver and steer the spacecraft in space, failed, and they detected more helium leaks. They did dock on June 6th. They were supposed to stay till the 14th of June, but the problem is the helium leaks are continuing. And without the helium to pressurize the thrusters, okay, it actually pressurizes the propellant in the thrusters, they're not sure if the propellant is, or rather if the thrusters are going to function properly. So will they be able to get back safely? Will they be able to, maneuver in space safely away from the space station?
On Friday, they held a news conference, and the folks at NASA and Boeing stressed that the crew is not in any danger.
No.
They even went as far to say they're not stranded.
Yes.
But it seems like they are. It seems like they're a little stuck.
Well, they're kind of stuck if they want to take their own ride home. There's a couple of other options to get home.
There's no Uber?
No Uber at the space station. The Dragon crew module has made four successful dockings and astronaut transfers. And so that's a possibility if one of those could be readied in time. There's the Soyuz spacecraft. There's actually one docked to the spacecraft right now. There's actually a Dragon docked on the spacecraft right now on the ISS. So they have ways to come home. The problem is Boeing is about $1.5 billion in the red on this program already. And that kind of compounds what's going on with their aircraft program. So, this is tough. Their official line is that they are studying the problem because they're not going to get their hands on this hardware. That's the problem is in what's called the service module, which is attached to the crew capsule. And that gets discarded during reentry and will presumably burn up. So they're not going to be able to get their hands on it to study it. So they're doing every test they can think of to make sure it's safe to come back. And NASA says that they will not return unless they're 100% sure it's safe.
And to be fair, they are most likely doing due diligence, taking time to assess the problem. But the name Boeing doesn't inspire a lot of confidence these days.
Yeah, not these days.
Any Boeing type of flight, commercial or space.
Well, Boeing has definitely had some hard times lately.
All right. We'll keep an eye on that and hopefully they get back soon. Let's talk about some of spiders, some eight-legged friends. Joro spider?
The Joro spider. J-O-R-O. And I think they produce it. I know they pronounce it Joro. There's a whole bunch of researchers from the University of Georgia, and they put out some press releases about this that are looking at the spiders. They're an invasive species from East Asia. They got here in about 2013. They think that they came in shipping containers, and they are very large. There are some large spiders around here, but these are about 4 inches with their legs extended. They're bright yellow and black, and they actually have red on their abdomen, some of them. So they're striking looking spiders. Add to that, they're orb weavers, which means they weave huge webs, octagonal orb webs. So they're going to stick out when they get here. Now, right now, most of the sightings are around Atlanta, some in the Carolinas, some in East Tennessee. There's a website called jorowatch.org, JOROWATCH.org, which has pictures and a map with sightings so you can kind of track their progress.
They're moving up the East Coast.
Yeah, I think the question is, will they spread and to where? And the answer is yes. And most of the continental U.S. is where they're going to spread to, because their native territory in East Asia includes some very cold areas and some very hot and steamy areas. So they're in Atlanta right now, but they will be coming up the East Coast, and they will presumably get to this area sometime perhaps in the next decade.
I mean, lots of people afraid of spiders. These are new. Yeah. They're kind of colorful. They're big. But realistically, what can they do to humans? Can they kill you? Or?
No, nothing. Okay. They're very shy and very retiring. They will run away from you. The worst thing is that they're going to compete with a native species for food. They're not dangerous to humans. If you have arachnophobia, certainly that's something that you might want to think about. Now, the most interesting thing about them is they do this process, the spiderlings, that's the name for a little baby newly hatched spider, do a process called ballooning, where they crawl to a tall branch, let out a long silk thread, which is caught by the wind, and away they go. And that's actually how they spread. There are spiders around here that do that, and you will see spiders ballooning in the spring. I notice them every once in a while. So it's not like this crazy thing that no other spider does, but it is kind of interesting.
Yeah, they have been spreading, but it will take a little while for them to move up in this direction.
Yes, yes. One estimate I saw was 10 miles per year, but I don't know. We'll have to wait and see.
Let's talk about the rotation of the Earth's inner core is slowing down.
Yes, yes.
That doesn't seem good. I don't know anything about it, just those words together don't seem good.
It sounds like a beginning of a science fiction right. movie. The Earth's core definitely does have an effect on it. Now, we're talking the inner core, okay, the solid inner core. If you remember your layers of the Earth, we have the crust on the outside, then the mantle, which is very big and thick, then a large liquid layer, the outer core, which is liquid iron and nickel, so hot and under such high pressure, and then the solid inner core. And the interplay between the cores is actually what generates our magnetic field and can regulate the length of time of rotation of the Earth, so it could affect how we measure time. But what's happening is this, that first of all, the inner core is about the size of the moon. It's made out of iron and nickel. And the way they've been looking at it is with earthquake wave analysis. There's a recurring earthquake in the South Sandwich Islands, which is down south of southeast of the tip of South America, I believe, if I remember my geography. And this recurring earthquake keeps sending out earthquakes from the same spot. And these waves travel through the Earth. They go through the mantle. They go through the outer core, the inner core. These are P waves, by the way, for you earth science teachers out there. And then is detected by seismographs on the other side of the Earth, in this case in Kyrgyzstan. Now, this same earthquake has occurred because it's a recurring earthquake. It's a place where the crust is doing a really weird bent thing, and it just keeps snapping, and releasing earthquakes. And it's released 121 earthquakes from 1991 to 2023. Now, as these waves go through the Earth, it's like almost like X-raying your arm to see if the bone is broken. We're getting a snapshot of the inside of the Earth. And so we're getting a look at the inner core. And the inner core is not a smooth surface. It actually has some surface features to it. And they're noticing that in relationship to the outer crust of the Earth where we live, that there's actually some displacement going on.
So when you talk about this altering time, what does that mean? Does it mean?
Well, it could potentially alter the rotational period of the planet. In other words, how long we reckon a day is.
So it makes the day longer.
Well, it's the amount. It could make it longer. It could make it slower, depending on if it's speeding up or slowing down, because there is some evidence that from 2003 to 2008, the core super rotated. In other words, it went faster than the outer part of the Earth. And from 2008 to 2023, it slowed down, but it did it in like really gradual steps. It was weird to look at the graph because it looked like it stepped down. Okay. Now the change is only about 0.15 degrees per year. So it's not a huge change, but this is going to make the geologists really kind of have to rewrite their models of what's going on inside the Earth.
So you're not going to really notice it.
You and I will not notice it. No.
But over time.
Over time, yeah, it definitely could have an effect. And this is just a very unique situation where we got this very unique setup to get this picture. You know, it could have been doing this for millions of years, speeding up and slowing down, and we don't know because we have this tiny little data set.
I guess you have to wait to gather any real impact on this.
More data is always better.
But then you might notice that the days are longer or shorter.
You and I, once again, we're not going to notice that.
You're like, why is it so light outside? What's going on? Oh, that's the inner core of the Earth.
It's that inner core thing.
It's that inner core thing. That was Joe Johnson with Science Stories. And we're going to talk about a different inner core, our health core, with Maggie Fitzpatrick from the Sullivan County Democrat. Her column, Moving Toward Health, is out today. And we'll find out how to achieve goals that last after a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you.
who donate at WJFFradio.org.
You're on the go, and Radio Catskill can go with you. Listen live to Radio Catskill on your phone. Just type WJFFradio.org into your browser and listen wherever you are. Stay up to date on local news, culture, and NPR on the go on your phone with Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. Every Tuesday, we check in with Maggie Fitzpatrick. She is the health and wellness columnist for the Sullivan County Democrat. Her column is Moving Toward Health. It's out on newsstands now or SC Democrat Online. Good morning.
Good morning.
So your column today, How to Achieve Goals That Last. Before we jump into it, I wanted to ask you, do you ever look into astrology or read your horoscope or anything?
Not often, no.
So I kind of check in.
Okay.
I used to check in a little more obsessively. But anyway, I'll check in and see what's going on, right? So today I read somewhere that there's a balsamic moon. Do you know about this?
No.
It's a phase of the moon where it's usually about 3.5 days before the new moon, which is coming up. And it's said to be a potent time for rest. A time when you put down the, quote, doing energy and invite stillness, reflection, and nothingness in your life.
I am feeling that way today, honestly.
Yeah, so you mentioned that to me.
Lean into it.
Right. So it's balsamic, not just a vinegar.
Yeah.
It's a phase of the moon.
I was going to say, is it like a glaze? You know, is it tasty?
This glaze is meant to get you to slow down and be still. And you kind of reflect on that in your column.
I do.
Because you say, in order to move quickly toward our goals with lasting results, is to slow down.
Yeah.
You're balsamic and you don't even know it.
I didn't even know it, but it's just aligning perfectly, you know? Very interesting.
Yeah. So let's talk about this, idea of slowing down to speed up.
Yes. I always like to give you a little bit of like a paradox, you know? It's like, how do we go faster? Well, we must go slower first in order to do that. So when it comes to our goals, right, we always want to get to the end as fast as possible, right? I think it's normal to feel that way, especially in the way the whole world is, right? Everything is like that, whether it's ordering something online or, you know, how quickly can we get lunch? Like everything is how fast can I do this, right? And so the same thing happens when it comes to whatever our health goals are. But unfortunately, our bodies don't really respond well that way when it comes to lasting change, right? So we can create results quickly. However, when we do that, it doesn't usually last because we're not really creating a foundation for ourselves.
Yeah, and you talk about building the foundation like you're building a house. You want to have that foundation. You know, I want to just go back quickly to the instant gratification part of it. It's a little harder these days, especially in the last few decades where things have developed so quickly in terms of technology, where you are instantly gratified with just this little device in your hand. You can get whatever you want. And you do kind of fall into a trap of just expecting that quickly and right away.
Yeah.
But that foundation is the most important part. Let's talk a little bit about how you can build your body house.
Yeah, I like the house analogy because it's easy to imagine, right? But if you were to build a house without a strong foundation or a foundation at all, the house is going to fall down pretty quickly, right? It's not going to be around for a long time. But if you take the time to really plan and make sure that you're building the right house for the location and you're putting the right foundation in and it's strong and it's capable of holding however many floors you're going to put on top of it, then that house is going to stick around much longer. Never mind the fact that if your foundation is square, right, and it's big enough, it's going to be easier to put up the walls. It's going to be easier to put up the drywall and the paint, and the doors are going to close properly because it's all square and in line, right? Whereas if you rush through those initial steps, everything that comes after it is going to be more challenging, right? And the same thing applies when it comes to our health. If we rush the initial things that we need to do for whatever our goal is, it makes everything else after it more challenging. Whereas if we move a little bit more slowly, but more importantly, intentionally in the beginning, and we get clear and focused on what it is we're trying to do, we can then speed up afterwards.
So here's where the balsamic comes in, the balsamic moon idea comes in of slowing down. You're talking about breaking down these goals into steps.
Yeah. I think it's important that we don't just focus on I like to call it an outcome goal, right? So I talk about simple examples like you want to lose 10 pounds. That's an outcome goal, right? This is the outcome of what I want. It's important we know what that is. But in the day to day, we have to focus on what are called process goals or actions that we can take in order to get there. So if I continuously say to myself, I want to lose 10 pounds, I want to lose 10 pounds, I want to lose 10 pounds, all I'm thinking about is how I'm not there yet and how much faster I want to get there. And it's perpetuating this cycle of needing to be there as fast as possible. Where if I take that outcome goal and I break down the processes or the actions I need to take in order to get there, which could look like going for walks, exercising, eating vegetables, drinking water, going to sleep at whatever time, right? If I break down those action steps or process goals, then I can focus on those things and I receive those hits of dopamine in that instant gratification of checking off those processes, right? Which is leading me towards this outcome goal, but I'm not feeling the need to just kind of skip all those steps and get to the end as quickly as possible because I'm focused on the processes, which is going to help me build that foundation and actually create results that last versus just getting there as fast as possible and then gaining all of that weight back.
Well, and you're also not focusing on overhauling every single one of those categories at once. You're focused on one step at a time.
Yeah, you have to really be honest and realistic with yourself about what you have capacity to change at once, right? And it's easy to say, I'm going to do everything at once and I can do that with my job and taking care of my kids and my dog and cooking all the meals and doing all of these things. And it's like, is that actually realistic? Probably not. And that's when we set ourselves up for failure because we're rushing through that foundation again, right? And everything's going to come crashing down afterwards. So how can we be realistic with ourselves and say, okay, I know I want to do this as quickly as possible because my brain is like telling me I need to do it faster, but how can I keep the mindset that I want this to last? I want this to last. So let me set myself up for success by taking on parts of this project that I can actually handle and create changes with instead of just trying to do everything at once.
You say, don't be afraid to slow down now so you can speed up later. Don't be afraid.
Don't be afraid.
Right.
It is scary.
It is. It's a little daunting when you think about it in some ways. You know, I'm thinking about this as we're talking. Next week, our fund drive officially starts on the 8th. That's when we go on air and do more pitching and things. You can donate now, though, to end it sooner if you want.
WJFFradio.org. Really?
But I know that I'm going to have to spend more time and more energy devoted to that fund drive, being on the air more often and pitching more often. So this week, I'm taking time to rest and try to still myself. I know there's a holiday weekend or a holiday coming up. Take advantage of that holiday to also like sort of prepare for that time. So not being afraid of this task that's ahead of us to raise this money, which we have to do every time we have a fund drive. We have an amount to raise that seems daunting, but then when you kind of break it down, it's like, okay, I'm ready for this. I'm ready to go. I'm going to do it. So I'll be well rested, I hope, by Monday, but it's in line with what you're saying.
Yeah, that's great. And I'm sure you're also doing things in this time to prepare for that week, right? You're not waiting until next week to do everything. It's like, okay, what can I do now in this time of rest, but also preparation to take on this high intensity like week, right? Or 2 weeks, however long your drive is. And that's kind of this similar concept of let me pick out what's important. Let me slow down. Let me focus on what I'm trying to do now. So that way when I have to run right next week into that fun drive, then I actually can do that because I've laid a foundation for myself to be able to take off from, right?
Yeah. With all that said, July 4th coming up, a time for, outside barbecues, having some fun, being out, a little bit more excess than you would normally have as you're celebrating the day and the weekend. Any advice or tips on how to handle the holiday?
Yeah. Honestly, the biggest piece of advice I have is eat breakfast. Eat breakfast before you go somewhere because breakfast is really important for stabilizing our blood sugar and it helps us make good decisions. And it also just like stabilizes our hunger cues throughout the day. And so it's more important that we kind of stick to somewhat of a routine like that and allow ourselves to eat what comes after that instead of saying, I know I'm going to eat, you know, so much later. So F it, I'm not going to eat breakfast. And then I'm going to just pig out for the whole day. Right. I don't think like restricting ourselves at events is the best way to go. So I would say set yourself up for success by just eating a normal breakfast first, and then it will be easier to make decisions you like as the day goes on.
Yeah. Good advice. Maybe put a little balsamic on your
breakfast.
Yeah.
Yep.
Maggie Fitzpatrick is the health and wellness columnist for the Sullivan County Democrat. Moving Toward Health is her column in the paper today or online, scdemocratonline.com. Thank you.
Thank
Happy
you.
Fourth.
Yeah.
And speaking of the 4th, not really a military or veterans holiday, but we're all able to celebrate thanks to the service of those in uniform. That includes the National Guard. The Army National Guard is a part-time state-based military component that serves a dual mission. Each guard unit serves under the command of their state governor to respond to natural disasters or other state emergencies. In addition, guard units can be activated to defend the nation when needed. There are 54 units in total across the United States and the U.S. territories. I spoke to Staff Sergeant Victor Ayala about the New York National Guard in advance of Independence Day.
So just to paint a vivid picture, the New York Army National Guard is a dual purpose component of the Army. So we're considered a reserve component of the Army, but we belong to New York State. So we have two missions, a state mission as well as a federal mission. So we serve the governor of New York State as well as the president of the United States.
So what is your state mission? What is that?
A state mission is essentially to aid to civil authority, civil unrest, respond to natural disasters. For example, when COVID happened, the National Guard was very fortunate. We got put on active duty orders to support the state with vaccination efforts, testing efforts, stuff like that. I think one of the most recent things that we supported in New York State was the Buffalo snowstorm that occurred. We got activated up there. We drove up there. We stood up there for a couple weeks, assisted local hospitals, nurses, doctors, in being able to get to where they needed to be to work. Stuff like that is pretty much what we do for the state of New York.
And then at the federal level, the national level, that's when there was like a bigger emergency going on. Have you encountered any of those in your service so far?
So in my service particularly, I have deployed. I've been to Ukraine, Germany, Poland. Supporting joint multinational training groups. It's a great opportunity if you want to travel. You definitely get to travel a lot. I've been places I've probably never been before if it wasn't for the uniform. All over the United States, Arkansas, Texas, Virginia, Mississippi, you name it, I've probably been there.
As part of the National Guard, is this your full-time role? Or, you know, I think some people might have a perception that National Guard is sort of a part-time thing. How does that work?
Correct. So the National Guard is known as the citizen soldier, per se, but there are full-time opportunities. If it's something that you enjoy, supporting your local community, servicing your state, there are opportunities. For me, for example, I'm a recruiting and retention NCO. I'm considered AGR, Active Guard Reserve, and I work full-time down in Middletown, just talking to kids, adults, about how they can serve their community, how they can serve their country, joining the National Guard. It's part-time. 1 week in a month, 2 weeks in the summertime for annual training. So you do the math, you're only really wearing your uniform for about 40 plus days. But with us as the National Guard, if you're pursuing like further education, a lot of people don't know, the Army National Guard, we cover state tuition assistance for colleges 100% all the way up to a bachelor's degree. As well as if you decide, hey, I want to go for my master's or whatever, our federal tuition assistance kicks in. That's where we get kind of assistance from both sides, state and federal. So a lot of people, I consider the National Guard a hidden gem in the military just because of all the perks and benefits that we do get, as well as full-time opportunities.
What was it about the National Guard that attracted you? Why did you join?
So the reason why I joined, I remember being in middle school. I went to a middle school down in the Bronx. I grew up in the city, and I saw the Twin Towers get struck when I was in middle school, eighth grade. And as the older I got, I was like, man, I got to be part of something bigger than myself. You know, I wanted to serve my country and my community. And my cousin found, you know, he told me about the National Guard, and I was 21 at the time. And I was like, I graduated high school. I couldn't afford to go to college. So he told me like, hey, why don't you come and join the National Guard? Maybe this can help you and you can serve your community and state. And I went for it full throttle. And here I am 15 years later. I have 15 years of service. 5 more years, I'll have my 20. I'm currently 36. So everybody knows how to do a little bit of math. I'll have my 20 years of service real soon.
Congratulations.
Thank you, sir.
You mentioned you've been all over the world. You've been all over the United States. As a member of the National Guard, it might be hard to say something that's a favorite thing because you're on a mission. You're probably in a situation where you're helping to secure an area or correct. Some other issue. But what is it about those places that you've been that have stuck to you, stuck out for you, stuck out in your memory?
My biggest thing was experiencing different cultures, right? Different languages, the way that other people think outside of our state or our country. You meet all kinds of different people from different races, religions, creeds, colors. And it's amazing because in the military, none of that matters. We're all on the same team. It's one team, one fight is what we call it. And it's just a different experience where you get to go and see all kinds of different places. Like for us, for New York, right? We think we got the best pizza, for example. But you go down to like a state like Arkansas and you try the pizza and you're like, wow, this is almost just as good as New York or a steak, you know, like it's great. It's a great experience. A lot of people don't know too much about it, but definitely look us up. If you ever consider military service, we're right down in Middletown, super local to the community. Like I live in Middletown. I just bought a house there. So we're very local to the community and we support the community a lot.
What is one of the biggest misconceptions about the National Guard?
So the biggest misconception is a lot of people think that we don't deploy, that we don't go anywhere. But we do. We do. You'll know well ahead of time. But essentially, the way it works for us is you enlist, you take your test, the ASVAB, you go to Albany MEPS for your physical, you pick your job, right? We have over 180 different jobs to choose from. You join, you complete your training, you come back to New York and you live your day-to-day life in your state. You serve 1 week in a month, 2 weeks in the summer, go to college, whatever it is you want to do. If you want to pursue full-time opportunities, we have them. For me, for example, before becoming a recruiting and retention NCO, I was a wheeled vehicle mechanic, a 91 Bravo. So that's what I did basically every day, Monday through Friday on Camp Smith in Peekskill, fixing heavy equipment vehicles, right? Pulling motors, transmissions, stuff like that. So there's a lot of skills that you can acquire through the military that are applicable to the civilian life after your service, which I always tell people, like, pick a job. When you join in the military and you're deciding, hey, this is what I want to do, pick a job that's going to benefit you after your service, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. What do you want folks to know on this July 4th about the National Guard and the service that you and your colleagues provide?
I just want everybody to remember that there is a way to serve your community. There is a way to serve your state and your country and still live a normal life, right? Like a lot of people think joining the military, they're going to be sent away somewhere. They're not going to see their friends anymore, their family.
In a barracks or something, yeah.
Right, or they're not going to be able to see their kids. That's one of the common misconceptions as well. With the National Guard, it's a little different, especially New York Army National Guard. Our job, my job as a recruiter, is to put you within 50 miles to your home or record. So like that, you're not traveling too far from your family, your children, even the dogs and the cats. You know, we have people out there who don't have kids, but they have the fur babies, what we call it, right? I have a dog too. So you always, everybody's always worried about those kind of things. But with the New York Army National Guard, you have that opportunity to still serve, still get benefits, get your college paid for, go to a trade school, and be able to go home every night.
And still serve your country, still serve your state.
Exactly.
And your community. If folks want to get more information, where can they go?
They can visit NewYorkArmyNationalGuard.com, and you'll find us. Or you can just Google us in Middletown. You'll be able to find us that way as well.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your service, and thanks for talking to us today.
Thank you for having me, sir.
That's Staff Sergeant Victor Ayala of the New York National Guard. We'll take a break, and when we come back, the Calicoon Business Association and events coming up this summer. This is Radio Chatsko.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, the economics of Broadway are very tough, but things are working out for the new hit show, Stereophonic.
We just keep saying over and over again, when will it slow down? When will this slow down? When will it sort of stop? And it just has not yet.
And can the unlikely success of Stereophonic help change the grim future of the theater?
We are more than just a luxury.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. This afternoon at 1 o'clock on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Located on the banks of the Delaware River, Calicoon offers a lot of different activities. Also, there's an abundance of wildlife to enjoy along the upper Delaware River Valley and the Delaware River. One of the ways that those
that information gets out about the town is through the Calicoon Visitors Association. And the president of the Calicoon Visitors Association, Nicole Valance, is on the phone now to tell us about what's going on in Calicoon this summer. Nicole, good morning.
Good morning. Hi, Tim. Thanks for having us today. Appreciate it. I'm Nicole Valance from the Calicoon Business Association, and we want to talk to you this morning a little bit about Calicoon Country Fair coming up on July 27th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. and want to invite everyone to come to the historic Calicoon on the Delaware for a day full of live music, line dancing, an artisan's market, art, food, games, pony rides, a dunk tank, face painting, lawn games, and so much more.
And Calicoon Country Fair, in a long line of events that happened in Calicoon, the big tractor parade just happened last month. I hear it was a record-breaking event that day with everybody in town. The 5K is coming up at the Youth Center. But the Country Fair is kind of the main thing this summer after all of that on the 27th. What are some of the things that are going on there? You mentioned a few of them. What can folks expect on the 27th?
Yeah, so we have tons of activities for families and children, as well as adults and folks who are coming for shopping and enjoying the wonderful restaurants that are in Calicoon. We'll have pony rides. We're going to have face painting. We have April Michelle from Delaware Youth Center doing line dancing at the depot starting around 11 o'clock. So that's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to have our dunk tank, which is usually a fun feature, lawn games in Calicoon Creek Park. And a large vendor market. This year is actually our 40th anniversary, which just came to our attention. We knew it was running.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Years.
Well, happy 40th.
Yes. Yes. It's so exciting. So we actually are returning back to a hamlet-wide event. So we'll have Lower Main Street and the cross streets across the depot and the parking lot closed down. It'll be a full town event. And we have some cideries or breweries at the depot. We'll have pony rides, animal petting, all of the kids' activities. We're going to have in Calicoon Creek Park because it's just a safer environment for the kids and more fun on the grass. But the vendor market is going to extend all through Lower Main Street and where the typical hamlet parking lot is during the day. It's going to be pedestrian only just on those streets from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. So, speaking of the vendor market, we do have a few spaces still available, and we've extended the deadline for applications through July 14th or until they fill up. So we're looking for artisans, artists, vintage, antiques, or any businesses selling goods or services that are produced or designed in the region. So arts and crafts, glassware, wood carving, pottery, ceramics, jewelry, home decor, textiles, garden and farm, flowers and plants, farm stands, anything that anything that is local to the area or, you know, our surrounding counties. So we're inviting vendors who would be interested to please either download our application. It's on visitcalicoon.com. If you go to the events tab, there's a link to the application, or they can just email events.calicoon@gmail.com and somebody from the events team will get back to them.
And that, so you have an open call for the artisan market vendors. Is there still a call for musicians and performers to perform on the day?
Actually, right now we are filled up on the depot stage for the day of. We're going to have, like I said, line dancing with April Michelle from the DYC. We're going to have Nick Broden playing with us. Some folks know him as Dr. Six String. Jim Barry, Lucas Rotman, the Poison Love Band, who's one of our local favorites, Brinkerhoffers, who are really deeply involved with our community and just up the street from Depot. Rich Northrup will be playing, and also Kazin Moon and Faith Kelly will be playing. They're also our in-house tech, audio techs for the day, so they make sure everything is running smoothly, and they're really, just want to give them a shout-out to say thank you for everything they've done. This is, I think, the third year that they're doing all of the audio and visual tech for the association, and they do an awesome job, and we're just
shout out to the tech, shout out to the crew members. They for doing all the backstage
work. Everything smooth.
Exactly. You mentioned the Calicoon Depot stage, and the Calicoon Business Association, along with Calicoon Depot and the Upper Delaware Scenic Byway, are having another public town hall to talk about the Calicoon Train Depot Visitor Center project. When's that coming up?
Yeah. So our Calicoon Train Depot Visitor Center project, long anticipated, which is a partnership from the CBA, the Upper Delaware Sink Byway, and of course the CDI, which is our development and management partner. So we're going to be having our next town hall on July 16th at 6 p.m. It's going to be at the Delaware Youth Center. Thank you to Delaware Youth Center for donating their lovely space for this important community event, and also to Tim Bruno of WJFF for once again agreeing to be our moderator at the last town hall. Who's that guy? Yeah, so we're really, really appreciative to you, Tim, for stepping up again to give us a hand. Last one was fantastically, and we're excited for this next town hall where everyone can see, can get more information on the community project updates. We're discussing the future of the Calicoon Depot, and it's really an essential platform for community members to learn about the project's histories, plans, timelines, and really have an opportunity to offer their insights and suggestions to actively participate in the shaping of the future of the site.
Yeah, there's new leadership. We've had Darko on, who's the new president of the Calicoon Depot CDI, the group that is partnering with you and Upper Delaware Scenic Byway Visitor Center to create that. I know they've been doing a few more events as well at the depot. And again, important to mention that this project is as an all-volunteer project. So people all pitching in. We were talking about the folks doing the behind the scenes pitching in stuff. It's all volunteer, the work that you guys are doing.
Yes, we have an all-volunteer board. The CDI and the Upper Delaware, by the way, have all-volunteer boards as well. So these are labors of love that we're doing for our community, and we're really excited to have the opportunity to do that. And yes, we have a new board at the CDI. There are some members who are on from last year who are awesome, and this whole new board is working together really wonderfully. We've really ramped up community outreach this year. The CDI board is making the effort to have a open house community day every the last Saturday of every month. And for most Saturdays, they also do additional community activities. Like we just had a paint your own watercolor arts and crafts day with Lockwood Creation Studio this past week. The month before, we had a book sale. There'll be a community flea market coming up later in the season. The CDI will announce those dates, but every month they try to have an additional activity to attract people onto the site, really get it activated. And as well, there's information about the project. They're giving depot tours. Our depot historian, Randy Bouchard, is often available giving presentations on the history of the depot and the rail line inside the depot during these events. And actually, he will also be giving presentations on the day of Country Fair. We have to get the time schedule, but they'll also be there giving presentations and a little slideshow about the history. So that's also very exciting.
All right. Well, we'll remind people before we go that if you want more information about the Calicoon Country Fair coming up July 27th or that town hall about the depot, you can go to visitcalicoon.com. Or you can go to the Calicoon Business Association's Facebook page for more information. And I expect you're going to have a big July 4th weekend in town, too. Nicole Valance, president of the Calicoon Business Association, thank you so much and happy 4th.
Thank you so much, Tim. Thank you for having us, and you have a wonderful day.
All right, that's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder that you can find this episode on all of our local programming at our website, wjffradio.org. While you're there, check out the One Small Step program. It's a partnership with StoryCorps we've been telling you about, where we're pairing individuals to have a conversation, not to debate politics, but to get to know each other as people. Take part in One Small Step. It's an effort to bring communities together one conversation at a time. You can find out the facts and apply to be part of it at our website, wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeff Works Office Solutions, located right on Main Street in Jeffersonville, New York. A newly renovated pet-friendly office space that rents by the day, week, or month, with hot desks, sound-insulated rooms, Wi-Fi, modern amenities, and 24-hour secure access. Online at jeffworksjville.com. And from The Cooperage Project, thecooperageproject.org. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Hi there, this is Brian, host of The Secret Show, Friday nights at 9. I'll be playing a mix of indie, alternative, college, rock, and pop. Some new music and some old classics. That's The Secret Show, Friday nights at 9, only on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, mostly sunny and nice, high 78, right now 74 at our Liberty Studios. Partly cloudy, low 55 tonight. Looking ahead, Thursday the 4th, thunderstorm in the afternoon and evening, high 78, and then some strong late Friday night through Saturday afternoon thunderstorms possible.